the Yum Yums with Shug Shug Sugar Baby. We start that set off with mini set, two songs. Kurt Baker, new music from him, hitting rock bottom. That's going to about do it for me. This is DJ Chris Wired. Thanks for listening to Breakfast for Dinner. No show next week. It is Anatomy of the Ear here on WRCT Pittsburgh. I'll be doing a necropunk show really, I guess, late, early in the morning, towards the end. You can check out the schedule on WRCT.org. So hope you check that out and all the other great stuff happening at Anatomy of the Year next week. We'll be back the following week. Until then, let me leave you with The Legal Matters and Independence Well Spent. Thanks for listening. This is WRCT Pittsburgh.
Welcome to Ebony Spectrum.
This is Rick Adams, host of Ebony Spectrum, with a Black World Media Network commentary. Just a thought. Hamas and the burning house. War is terrible, no matter who starts it or who ends it. Since the advent of the concept of total war, there have been wars conducted with no or little regard to the fate of civilian populations. The 9/11-2001 authorization for the use of military force in support of foreign forces against terrorist groups expanded the reach of the U.S. global presence. According to Conflict Management and Peace Science Journal, in 2020, the United States had 173,000 troops in 159 countries with 750 foreign military bases across 80 nations. The journal also claims that there are so-called shadow wars, defined as a somewhat covert military operations conducted on behalf of a smaller power against homegrown terrorists. The Israeli-Hamas war is a horrendous example of this phenomenon on steroids. Well, my African-American brothers and sisters, just when you thought things couldn't get worse, a list of 15 current shadow wars appear, and voila, 8 of the 15 are in Africa: Egypt, Niger, Nigeria, Libya, Kenya, Mali, Somalia, and Mauritania. The world is complex, and challenges confronting African Americans from the very beginning, first as the victims of a terribly flawed and immoral international economic policy called slavery, has produced a very complex situation indeed. For example, I can see not supporting the brothers and sisters in the 1776 revolt against the king, or in the War of 1812, when England offered to free them for enlisting on their side, or the Buffalo Soldiers fighting against Native Americans, or those drafted into the Vietnam War in my lifetime. But I can support the Buffalo Soldiers fighting the fascists in Germany and Italy during World War II. Please remember, an estimated 1,353,000 died in North and South Vietnam during the period of 1965 to 1974, and the Defense Department reported 58,000 American deaths. War is hell. Charging up San Juan Hill behind Teddy Roosevelt in Cuba, 1898 was heroic, but look at where the U.S., with its 300 million citizens, trying to crush Cuba's 11 million citizens with an embargo since 1962, lasting all my life, and to what end, I ask you? So before we celebrate Colin Powell and Barack Obama and Linda Thomas Greenfield, the United States Ambassador to the U.N., and U.S. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin, among many others, I am reminded of Dr. Martin Luther King's lament, "I fear I am integrating my people into a burning house." This was said to Harry Belafonte, who in shock asked, "What should we do?" And Dr. King replied, "Become the fireman and let us not stand by and let the house burn."
This next segment is from the Young Turks.
What is also true is that the occupation and what's happening to Palestinians is unbearable. There are people right now who are dying who have nothing to do with what Hamas did.
That was former President Barack Obama weighing in on the brutal airstrikes that have been killing innocent civilians in the Gaza Strip, drawing attention to the unbearable deaths of these innocent Palestinians. Now, Obama made these statements during an appearance on Pod Save America. Here's more of what he had to say.
What Hamas did was horrific, and there's no justification for it. And what is also true is that the occupation and what's happening to Palestinians is unbearable. If you want to solve the problem, then you have to take in the whole truth. And you then have to admit nobody's hands are clean, that all of us are complicit to some degree. I look at this and I think back, what could I have done during my presidency to move this forward as hard as I tried? I've got the scars to prove it. But there's a part of me that's still saying, well, was there something else I could have done? That's the conversation we should be having. Not just looking backwards, but looking forward.
Now, typically, when a former president comes out and says something that seems provocative or courageous, I'll be critical of them because it's like, hey, where was that courageous attitude when you were in charge? But to be fair to Obama, he actually had a notoriously frosty relationship with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu because he was one of the few presidents who, American presidents, who was willing to demand that Netanyahu pump the brakes when it came to illegal settlements and when it came to any brutality toward Palestinian civilians. And he also bumped heads quite a bit with Netanyahu when he secured the Iran nuclear deal, which I'll give you more details about in just a moment. Netanyahu did not want an Iran nuclear deal. Netanyahu has always been thirsty for war with Iran, and of course not to fight that war with just the IDF, but to pressure the United States to involve its own military in that war. So here's a video just kind of summarizing some of the issues they had when Obama was in charge.
Analysts say President Obama and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu despise each other.
There's a fundamental sense of mistrust.
Former State Department insider Aaron David Miller calls the relationship the most dysfunctional ever. Each side thinking the other is ignoring their interests.
I think the president looks at Netanyahu. He doesn't feel that there's much respect for American interests. And the prime minister looks at the president and considers him bloodless and insensitive when it comes to really understanding Israeli needs.
Remember that supposed to be private exchange between the then French president and Obama in 2011. Sarkozy saying, I cannot bear Netanyahu. He's a liar. Obama responding, but I have to deal with him even more often than you.
But look, it wasn't just Obama who had deep issues with Netanyahu. So did Donald Trump.
You've probably heard that Donald Trump and Benjamin Netanyahu, or Bibi as he's called, were best buds, that it was a bromance. Well, turns out that's By the end of his presidency, Donald Trump couldn't stand Netanyahu. He thought Netanyahu was disloyal and ungrateful for everything he had done for him. By the time I talked to Trump in April 2021, he was over Bibi.
I haven't spoken to him since, right? I didn't talk to him.
That's right. Donald Trump said F 'em when it came to Benjamin Netanyahu. And one more clip that's really important, because Trump disclosed that he did not believe that Netanyahu was ever really serious about pursuing peace. Let's watch.
What a lot of people don't know is that actually in the first year of his presidency, and Trump told me this, his relationship with Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas was very, very good.
And it was almost like a father. I mean, you know, he was so nice. Couldn't have been nicer. Now, the world and me, before I met with both of them, I thought it was the exact opposite. I thought the Palestinians were impossible and the Israelis would do anything to make peace and a deal. I found that not to be true.
And I find it very interesting and actually kind of surprising that, like Obama and Bill Clinton, Trump also came to the conclusion that Bibi was not sincere about wanting peace with the Palestinians.
I think he just tapped us along. They just tap, tap, tap. I don't think Bibi ever wanted to make peace.
I think Trump was right about that. I think Obama was right about Netanyahu's lack of concern with establishing a more peaceful environment between Palestinians and Israelis in that region.
Yeah, almost everybody who deals with Netanyahu thinks he's disgusting. One of the most immoral liars that the world has seen in a long time. So it's such a look, as a lot of our world leaders are a scar upon our nations, like Trump was to America and Dick Cheney was to America and Bush and Erdogan, Turkey, Netanyahu, Israel, Putin, Russia. These are all stains on these countries. Is Putin, the bloodthirsty Putin, really a representative of the Russian people? I hope not. And I don't think so at all. Okay, and I don't think Netanyahu's a good representative of the Israeli people. Everyone loathes him for good reason, All he cares about is himself. He has no morality at all. And he's willing to kill as many innocent civilians as any terrorist. Let's be honest about it. Let's be honest about it. So he's now killed, what, seven times as many civilian Palestinian civilians as the leader of Hamas has. So those are facts. We say, oh, oops, it was an accident. It was an accident that I killed 10,000 civilians. No one thinks it's an accident. Only like people who are just obsessed with defending Israel, no matter what, would say that. No rational human being would thinks that all 10,000 civilians was just an accident, just collateral damages. We were getting the 13 Hamas guys. Okay, so one, I want to give credit to Barack Obama. I often criticize him for not coming out and making statements, being comfortable in his home. Oh, I'm an ex-president. Oh, I don't get to say anything, right? No. We could use your moral clarity from time to time. And here, credit where credit is due. Thank you. You see that now? Everybody's talking about what Obama said. And how even Obama is saying, how many civilians are we going to kill? See, we need that moral clarity from time to time. So thank you, President Obama. Okay, now Trump, it breaks up into two different things. We covered that story before. Trump is bitter at Netanyahu for a lot of personal stuff, not backing him on the 2020 election, which is absurd. He thought he didn't thank him enough, etc. And on that one, though, that's only half absurd, because Trump did everything for Netanyahu.
Yes, very true.
And he moved our embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, which Netanyahu wanted. He got out of the Iran peace deal, which Netanyahu wanted. He killed the top Iranian general. Netanyahu was thrilled about that. Trump almost started a war for Netanyahu, and Netanyahu still was like, who cares? Me. Okay, ironically, him and Trump are a good couple that way. They don't care about any other human being other than themselves. But the substantive things that Trump said, that's the second half. Those are very real and very honest. And you heard it for yourself right there. Whether you love Trump or you hate Trump, there's no question that the second half of what he said is absolutely true. Netanyahu has never wanted peace. He profits from war. He profits from death. And he would rather, just like Dick Cheney here in America and on with all these different warmongers in these different countries, they think war and innocent people being murdered is helpful to my political career. So they have no interest in peace. Netanyahu has never wanted peace. He's a monumental liar. And the Israeli people should fire him immediately. And for God's sake, and for Israel's sake, let alone the Palestinians, do peace. Peace right away. Two-state solution instantly. That way the world can heal and the world can finally, wouldn't it be amazing if the world accepted Israel and said, okay, you're not occupying people anymore. You're not imprisoning and oppressing people anymore. Welcome
to civilization.
And to the nations of the world that have agreed to certain moral rules. And Israel, to this moment, run by right-wingers like Netanyahu, say, no, we demand to oppress Palestinians, I guess, forever. Literally forever. We demand it. And if anyone disagrees, they're anti-Semitic. Yeah. That stuff's not working at all anymore. In the world, in America, anytime anybody says that now, it's a laughing stock, total joke. Oh, you're using that stupid old excuse? And by the way, it's such a sick thing to do, because there's real anti-Semitism in the world. And it's a giant problem here in America. And then now you want to use it for political tricks so you can kill more Palestinian civilians? Nah, that's not going to fly.
Joining me now is Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Mr. Prime Minister, welcome back to Meet the Press.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
We really appreciate your being here. This is our first chance to talk to you since the horrific attack by Hamas against Israel on October 7th. Of course, now the ground offensive to eradicate Hamas is underway. Mr. Prime Minister, can you tell us, how will you know when you have achieved your objective, and how close are you to that goal?
We've set a specific target, that is to destroy Hamas's military capabilities and to destroy its governance capabilities over the 2 million people that it holds hostage in Gaza. That is something that we are achieving step by step, and I assure you we'll complete the task. If you want peace, destroy Hamas. If you want security, destroy Hamas. If you want a future for Israel, the Palestinians, the Middle East, destroy Hamas. We're absolutely intent on achieving it. And what I can tell you, Kirsten, is given the extraordinary performance of the Israeli army in the last few days, the last few weeks, we're going to achieve it. We'll do it with as few civilian casualties as we can and with maximum casualties on the Hamas terrorists, which we're achieving day by day, hour by hour. We'll complete the task. Victory.
Do you think it will take months? Will it take years? What should people be expecting?
I don't think it's going to take the time that it took the United States and the international coalition to defeat ISIS or to defeat Al-Qaeda. It took you many years. I don't think it's going to be many years. But I've set targets and not a deadline. And we're proceeding as quickly as we can, but also as carefully as we can, because we want to minimize civilian casualties, and we want to minimize casualties on our side while maximizing the casualties on the of the Hamas terrorists. And we're actually achieving both. I would say the ground offensive that we began is actually reducing the amount of civilian casualties, because the population, the civilian population in Gaza, is heeding our call to vacate the territories, the zone of fighting, get out of harm's way. Even though Hamas is trying to keep them in harm's way, we're succeeding in that. So the level of civilian casualties is coming down, importantly, and our military successes are coming up. That's important as well.
Let's talk about what's happening at Al-Shifa Hospital. There are reports that there's been a loss of power, which has caused the death of patients and even some infants. And I know that Israel has said Hamas is headquartered there. Even if that is the case, does that justify jeopardizing the lives of sick people and babies, Mr. Prime Minister?
No, on the contrary, we offered actually last night to give them enough fuel to operate the hospital, operate the incubators and so on, because we have obviously no battle with patients or with civilians at all. And I think every civilian death, every dead baby is a tragedy. But that tragedy should be placed squarely at the responsibility of Hamas, that is keeping its military installations inside hospitals, its command posts inside hospitals, inside schools, inside UNRWA, UN facilities, and so on. So we obviously don't want to give them immunity, but at the same time, we're sensitive to this issue. So we offered this help. They've refused it. I've offered something else. I've said, let's build field hospitals. I asked the Emirates. I asked the French president, who sent a floating hospital ship. We've asked other countries to the UN, UNRWA, and so on, build field hospitals. Let's move the patients out of these Hamas command posts in the hospitals to these safe places. So far, they've moved a few patients, not enough. I hope more will move. We're trying to deal with this as carefully as we can while not giving sanctuary to Hamas.
I just want to be very clear, though, on the fuel, because the Red Cross says it is ready to get fuel into Gaza, into these hospitals that so desperately need it, where lives depend on it. Do you have a plan to get the fuel in and to get the fuel to these hospitals?
Well, we just offered Shifa Hospital the fuel. They refused it. So they, you know, so the fuel to run the hospital. See, what happens is, they want the Hamas that is hiding in the hospitals and placing itself there doesn't want the fuel for the hospitals. They don't give a hoot about the patients. They don't give a hoot about the civilians. Their spokesman said this. They said, Hamas is underground. Above ground, the civilian population, that's Israel's and the UN's responsibility. They don't care about the civilians. They don't care about the patients. But they want to get fuel that they'll take from the hospitals to their tunnels, to their war machine, the electricity they need to fire the rockets. They fire 10,000 rockets as we speak in Israel, against Israel's cities. And they continue to fight from those underground bunkers. So what we have to do is separate the two. We'll try to help those who need it in the hospitals, but not help the Hamas war machine.
Let's talk about the hostages. There are reports that there is a possible deal that would involve getting out women and children and the elderly. How close are you to reaching a deal to get more of the hostages out?
Well, Kirsten, I can say that we weren't close at all until we started the ground operation. In fact, we heard that there's an impending deal of this kind or of that kind, and then we learned that it was all hokum. It was nothing. But the minute we started the ground operation, things began to change.
So is there a potential deal, Mr. Prime Minister? Is there a potential deal?
There could be, but I think the less I say about it, the more I'll increase the chances that it materializes. And it's a result of pressure, military pressure, the extraordinary work that the IDF is doing, putting pressure on the Hamas leadership. That's the one thing that might create a deal. And if a deal is available, well, we'll talk about it when it's there. We'll announce it if it's achieved.
Do you know where all of the hostages are being held right now, Mr. Prime Minister?
We know a great deal, but I won't go beyond that.
Okay. There are a lot of mixed messages, as you know, coming out about what has been agreed to as it relates to humanitarian pauses. Can you be very clear for our audience? What has Israel agreed to in terms of daily humanitarian pauses? Have you agreed to four-hour daily pauses?
Yeah, let me be clear on what we agreed on and what we don't agree on. What we don't agree on is give a ceasefire to Hamas, with the exception of one intended for the release of our hostages. We're going to continue this to the end. We have to have victory. There's no substitute for victory, and we'll destroy Hamas, again, for our sake and for the sake of peace in the future. But in addition to that, we're fighting a war in which we are trying, doing our best in a way that very few armies have done, to give a corridor, a safe corridor for civilians to get out of harm's way. As we're doing that, Hamas is firing on the safe corridors that we're giving to the Palestinian civilians. So against all these obstacles, we're still calling on civilians to leave. And for that, we create pauses. That is a 4-hour pause, 3-hour pause, and this in a particular area, while the fighting proceeds elsewhere, to let the civilians out of harm's way. That's what we've been doing. We've been doing this with the cooperation with President Biden and the administration. And I think it's the right thing to do. We've created a humanitarian safe zone in southwest Gaza, below the fighting area, south of the fighting area. Mm-hmm. We've pushed in humanitarian aid to help those civilians. And I think it's a combination of the two things. Fight Hamas, don't give them safe haven, but allow the Palestinian civilian population to reach a safe zone.
Mr. Prime Minister, as you know, even those in the South say they do not feel safe. French President Emmanuel Macron has said there is, quote, no justification for the ongoing bombing of civilians. All over the world, you've seen protesters who are calling for an end to civilian deaths in Gaza. Can you win this war without global support?
We will win this war, because we have no other choice. There's no life for us. There's no future for us and our neighbors if we allow the axis of terror led by Iran, Hezbollah, Hamas, the Houthis, and their minions to dominate. We have an alliance for peace on the other side. It includes Israel, the United States, the moderate Arab states, and the rest of the civilized world. Now, it's a question, who wins? We have to win. There's confusion in many parts of the world. I have to say, not in the United States. I'm glad to see that the majority of the American people support Israel. They understand that we're fighting the just battle of civilization against barbarism. But those who protest for Hamas, you're protesting for sheer evil. There are a lot of misguided people out there who don't know the facts. You're talking to people who deliberately targeted civilians, who raped and murdered women, who raped, who beheaded men, who burnt babies alive, who kidnapped little babies and hostage and Holocaust survivors, you name it. These are the people that you're supporting. Now, you cannot, it's like in World War II, The Allies are fighting the Nazis, okay? Chancellor Kohl of Germany said that Hamas are the new Nazis. So imagine now, the Allies are fighting the Nazis. They've invaded France after they were attacked by the Nazis. They go into the cities of Germany. Obviously, the Nazis are fighting within civilian quarters, and civilians get killed. In fact, many of them were killed. Millions were killed. Who do you protest against? Well, do you protest against the Nazis, or do you protest against the Allies? And what these people are doing is protesting for sheer evil. That's wrong. By the way, it's a condemnation. It's an indictment of higher education in some of our universities.
Mr. Prime Minister, as you know, a number of the protesters are protesting the actions by Israel. Even the Secretary of State saying, quote, far too many Palestinian civilians have been killed. Let me ask you this. How many civilian deaths are you willing to bear in order to achieve your ultimate goal of eradicating Hamas?
If I had my way, there wouldn't be a single civilian death. If I had my way, no civilians would be killed. If Israel had its way and our calls would be heeded, they'll all be out of harm's way. And in fact, I'm saying this luckily now, and fortunately, hundreds of thousands have moved out of harm's way, heeding our calls and overcoming Hamas's threats at them at gunpoint not to leave the zone.
Do you know how many civilians have been killed, Mr. Prime Minister? Do you know how many civilians have been killed? Do you have an accounting of the number?
I wouldn't trust the Hamas numbers. When you say Gazan officials, that's Hamas officials.
What's your number? What's your number?
It's lower than theirs. And what is most important, Kirsten, is that we see a steady decline in the number of civilian deaths as we our ground action proceeds, because basically people understand that they have to clear the way and they leave. And remember, our goal, and we're taking extraordinary efforts to achieve it, is to minimize civilian casualties. This is our ethos. And here's the problem. We're faced with the most vicious kind of enemy who not only attacks civilians, but commits the other war crime of deliberately hiding behind their civilians. They use them as human shields.
Yeah.
They fire on our safe corridors that we give to Palestinian civilians. It's not Israel who's doing that. Yeah. So we have to at once try to focus our fire on the terrorists, try to minimize the civilian deaths, but at the same time not give immunity. Because I'll tell you what will happen, Christian. That'll, if this system, you know, we'll do everything we can to minimize civilian casualties, but you have to do everything in your power to lay the blame for the civilian casualties on where it belongs, on Hamas. We don't want to make human shields an effective strategy for terrorists.
Mr. Prime Minister, I have a few more questions to get through, and I know that we're running out of time, so let me keep moving. The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights said just this morning that while Hamas has committed war crimes, the collective punishment by Israel of Palestinian civilians amounts also to a war crime. Can you definitively say right now that Israel is not breaking international law?
Yes, I can say that what the commissioner said is hogwash, because we're the main difference is, are you deliberately targeting civilians? No, we're deliberately doing everything in our power to target the terrorists, and the civilians, as happens in every legitimate war, are sometimes what are called collateral damage. That's a laundered way of saying unintended casualties. That's clearly what Israel is doing. And what clearly Hamas is doing is the opposite. They're doing everything in their power to have their civilians hurt, because they want this ridiculous and wanton attack on Israel, on Israel's legitimacy to take root. And unfortunately, people are giving into this. If we lose sight, you know, if we lose the moral clarity of supporting the force that is fighting the terrorists that are hiding behind civilians and blaming the victim for the for these attacks, the victim who takes the just action to defend itself, then we'll never be able to fight the terrorists. Right. They'll always hide behind civilians, we'll never be able to fight them.
Let me ask you about Gaza, Mr. Prime Minister. You said Saturday you are opposed to the Palestinian Authority returning to control Gaza after the war, and you say that Israel will control Gaza for as long as is needed. Are you saying that Israel would reoccupy Gaza? And what do you say to those who say there should be an international force that governs Gaza after the war?
Well, I think Gaza has to make sure that it's not a threat to Israel. We said destroy Hamas, and if we want to have peace, we have to destroy Hamas. This is what Israel must do, and this is what Israel will do.
Would you accept an international force, Mr. Prime Minister? Would you accept force?
I think that the only force right now that can guarantee that Hamas, that terrorism does not reappear and take over Gaza again, is the Israeli military. So overall military responsibility will have to be in Israel. As far as the civilian management of Gaza, we need to see the following two things. Gaza has to be demilitarized, and Gaza has to be de-radicalized. Mm-hmm. And I think so far we haven't seen any Palestinian force, including the Palestinian Authority, that is able to do it. They teach their children to hate Israel. They're not fighting terrorists. They're paying for slay. That is, the more terrorists, Palestinian terrorists murder Jews, the more they get paid. And to this day, 36 days after the worst savagery perpetrated on the Jewish people since the Holocaust, the Palestinian Authority president has yet refuses to condemn this savagery. So, you know, we need a different authority. We need a different administration.
Who would that be? Who would that be?
I think it's too early to say. Kirsten, I think it's too early to say, but I can say one thing. The first task we have to achieve is defeat Hamas. The first task the Allies had to achieve before they could reconstruct Germany was to defeat the Nazis. These, as the German chancellor said, are the new Nazis. We'll defeat them, and then we'll work to have a demilitarized and a de-radicalized Gaza, which will give hope to these people. I mean, they're living under 16 years of horrendous, tyrannical rule of Hamas. We'll liberate them and we'll liberate ourselves from the from this horror, this scourge of barbarism that plagues not only us. It's not only our war. Kirsten, it's your war, too. It's the war of civilization against barbarism. We have to win it, and we will.
Very quickly, Mr. Prime Minister, as you know, many of Israel's top military, security and political leaders have taken responsibility for the attacks on October 7th. Can you be clear? Do you bear any responsibility for missing the attack?
Well, I've said that after the war, there'll be a thorough investigation and everybody will have to answer some very tough questions, including myself.
Do you bear responsibility?
But right now, we're focused on one thing.
Do you bear
responsibility? We all bear responsibility. Okay. We all, look, we're not, nobody's going to evade responsibility. That's, it's a non-issue.
But was your government distracted?
Not because it's a non-issue. Not because it's a non-issue, but because there'll be time to deal with it. And the time that we have to deal with it is right now to win this victory. After Pearl Harbor, after 9/11, did you delve into that question? Of course you did afterwards. But the first thing that you did was unite the entire country, America united, to defeat the terrorists. And Israel right now, after our 29 11s, 20, proportionately, that's what we suffered, 29 11s on a single day, right now, I'm uniting the country and we're going to fight until we achieve victory, nothing short of victory.
What do you say to those who argue your administration was distracted by the months of protests due to your judicial reforms?
We weren't distracted at all. There'll be time to answer all these questions, and I don't want to get into that. But again, I think right now, rather than relitigating the past, which many people perhaps would like to do, but I think it's wrong. I think right now we have to focus every ounce of energy, every ounce of will and resolve to achieve our goal of destroying Hamas, because our future depends on it. We won't have time to relitigate the past if we don't have a future. Let's make sure we have a future. Let's defeat Hamas, which is, again, the battle to defeat the axis of terror. Because if Hamas is the integral part of this axis of terror, and you know what? Everyone is sitting on the bleachers in the Middle East and in the world, and they want to see who's going to win, the good guys or the bad guys. And history doesn't favor automatically the good guys. They have to muster their resolve, their courage, their determination to defeat the bad guys. Otherwise, we get into a dark age. It's happened before in history. We must make sure it doesn't happen again. That's what we're focused on. And I know that most Americans understand that we have to defeat Hamas for our sake and for your sake as well.
Prime Minister Netanyahu, thank you so very much for all of your time this morning. We really do appreciate it.
Thank you, Kirsten.
After more than 2 months of Israeli attacks, health officials say the death toll in Gaza has now surpassed 18,000 people. Thousands more buried under the rubble and presumed dead. The Israeli Defense Forces estimate that 1,200 people were killed in the October 7 Hamas attack, with around 140 people still held captive in Gaza. Joining me now is Mark Regev, senior advisor to Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. He was previously Israel's ambassador to the United Kingdom. Ambassador Regev, thank you for being here. It has been a long time, so thank you for your time this evening for you. Let's start with this, what I just began with. 18,000 dead so far in Gaza, tens of thousands injured. The U.S. media has estimated that 2,000-pound bombs are being dropped, some 22,000 of them in just over 6 weeks. How has causing that much death and destruction, 80% of those dead estimated to be women and children, how does that achieve the goal of eradicating Hamas?
So, Joy, first of all, I want to thank you for allowing me to come on the readout. It is appreciated. I know you've been a critic of Israeli behavior, and I appreciate the opportunity to make my case, and that is very much appreciated. Our goal in this operation is, of course, not to target Gaza civilians. Our goal is to target the Hamas military machine. We have to eliminate that machine because of the threat it poses to the civilian population of Israel. Israeli people simply refuse to live any longer next to this terror enclave in constant fear that terrorists will cross the border in the middle of the night and murder their children. That's the bottom line. We have to end Hamas's rule of Gaza.
And may I ask how, I'll just re-ask again, how does killing 18,000 80% of whom are women and children, about half of whom really are children. How does that achieve the goal of eliminating Hamas's military infrastructure?
Joy, can I urge you please to be a little bit circumspect of those numbers? They are put out by the Hamas-controlled Ministry of Health in Gaza. And therefore, you have to presume that Hamas has reasons for playing with the numbers. You know that they were very cruel. They have no qualms whatsoever about killing people, innocent civilians. We saw that on October 7th. And so you can presume also they have few qualms about killing the truth.
So are you saying that you do not agree with the United Nations agreeing with those numbers? Most human rights groups agree with those numbers. You're saying you're casting doubt on that 18,000 number?
All I'm saying is we have to be very careful with numbers that are put out by Hamas. They would have you believe that they're all innocent civilians, while it's clear that Israel has been targeting Hamas operatives, Hamas terrorists, the Hamas infrastructure. Now, I have no doubt that there have been civilians caught up in the crossfire between the Israeli Defense Forces and the Hamas terrorists. Unfortunately, that's a reality of war. We as a democratic country want to keep those numbers as low as possible. But our job is made really difficult by the fact that Hamas has embedded itself under civilian areas, under neighborhoods, under mosques, under hospitals, even under schools, under UN facilities. Hamas, it's not just Israel says so. The United States has said so, the European Union, others. Hamas has adopted a strategy of using Gazan civilians as a human shield for its terror machine.
Let me ask you this question. If you were to discover, the Israeli military were to discover that Yahya Sinwar, who is the Hamas militant who planned the 10/7 attacks, was actually hiding in Israeli territory, hiding in a hospital there with his militants, with his men, would Israel drop 2,000-pound bombs on that hospital?
No, we'd probably, if it was inside Israel and we had control of the ground, we'd send in our special forces, as we have in the past when you've got sort of terrorist situations, and we would eliminate him. And we have now.
And you would not do that in Gaza?
We have. We have sent ground forces into Gaza. We're losing soldiers in very difficult firefights between us and the Hamas terrorists. We will reach Sinwar. It's only a matter of time.
Let me show you a piece of video and take a look at it. This is a group of Palestinian men who were marched out of, per U.S. media, including CNN, U.N. facilities, placed on the ground in their underwear and displayed in this way. Who took these pictures, sir? And is this not a violation of the Geneva Conventions to display these men in this way?
So can I say that the reason they've been asked to strip, except for their underwear, is because Hamas, of course, has been one of the pioneers of the use of explosive vests. And we've had too much experience with people from Hamas blowing themselves up and in the process killing Israelis around them. And that we would ask people who have surrendered to strip off temporarily. That is a necessity of difficult combat with a terrorist group that has used this tactic repeatedly in the past. Too many Israelis have died from Hamas terrorists who've exploded themselves with explosive vests.
I will note that Haaretz, an Israeli newspaper, has noted that 1 in 10 perhaps have been linked in some way to Hamas. 9 in 10 were doctors. One of them is the brother of Hani Al-Madoun, who works for the United Nations. I want to quickly play you a piece of video. This is the cousin.
I just wanted to say that these were men who were apprehended, taken prisoner in an area of combat. They're men of military age. It was a combat zone where there was heavy fighting. As a result, we were right to interrogate them all.
Who took those pictures, sir? Because I don't deny the right of the military to interrogate people that it's holding, but the Geneva Conventions are quite clear in saying that displaying people in a way that degrades their human dignity is a violation of the Geneva Conventions. So who took those pictures and who displayed them? Who distributed them?
We're taking steps to make sure that doesn't happen again. The stripping of them was necessary.
But who took the pictures in the first place?
We're getting trying to get to the bottom of that. It's not clear to me, and it's clear that it shouldn't have happened.
Let me play for you the relative of one of the people who was kidnapped on 10-7. This is the cousin of one of those people. Take a listen.
We are operating under the assumption that we are running out of time. You've just covered the renewed assault on southern Gaza. This is probably where my cousin is. This is where his phone was traced to. We know that the Israeli airstrikes are hurting the hostages. And now it's even more dense. It's impossible.
What is your answer to this young man, particularly given that Israeli officials have talked about doing things like filling the tunnels with seawater?
So his family is being held hostage by Hamas in Gaza. And one can only feel for him and try to support him, because Hamas they're guilty of the most heinous violence, most atrocious behavior.
But sir, it is Israel that is bombing the place where his family is. That is what I was asking you, because that is what he is asking. He's saying that his cousin is being held where Israel is bombing.
All I'm saying is we have to feel for this person and all the relatives who got loved ones being held hostage by Hamas in Gaza. We can only feel and try to understand the pain they're going through. But as to Israel's policy, as you know, a week ago, with the help of President Biden, we had a humanitarian pause for hostages to be released. And the only reason Hamas agreed to that pause is because they were under incredible military pressure. They didn't suddenly release hostages because they became humanitarian.
May I ask you very quickly, we're very much out of time, sir. They're in my ears, out of time. During the week-long pause, more than 100 civilian hostages were released, 81 Correct. Israelis, 23 Thai nationals, and one Filipino. How many have been released while Israel has been bombing, resuming bombing?
No, I think it's the opposite, though. I think the opposite.
But none have been released. They were released during the pause.
But the pause was agreed to because Hamas was desperate for a ceasefire. And it's possible that as we keep the military pressure on Hamas today, that will expedite a future release of hostages. Because Hamas, I started to say, you didn't let me finish the sentence. Hamas only releases hostages. They're not humanitarians. They only, as President Biden said, they respond to pressure. And the military pressure on Hamas that we're giving today, that can lead to the release of hostages tomorrow. There's no other way to work with these people. As President Biden said, they understand pressure.
Let me ask you one final question, and then I really do have to go. There have been some statements by leaders in Israel, including your prime minister, referring to things like the Amalek, which in the Bible means killing the women, the children, and the oxen, referring the deputy mayor of Jerusalem saying that Palestinians should be buried like ants, buried alive, talking about using nuclear weapons in Gaza, flattening it, saying turning it into a parking lot, saying this will be a new Nakba. Those kind of statements by leaders in Israel, how should the world interpret them?
So we will defeat Hamas. We have to dismantle its military machine and we have to remove it from power in Gaza. That's for the elementary safety of Israelis. But in achieving that goal, it's not just good for Israel, because we'll be safer and more secure. Our people won't have to live in fear of Hamas coming across, as I said before. But it's also good for the people of Gaza. It's good for the people of Gaza.
Stand by those statements?
Because,
the people of Gaza are being referred to as ants.
No, it's good for the people of Gaza, too, because Hamas has been ruling the Gaza Strip for 16 years. And what is their record of government? Just poverty, misery, bloodshed, and they've been terrible for the people of Gaza. Both sides of the frontier, Israelis and Palestinians, will be better off without Hamas.
We are out of time. I'm not sure the people of Gaza would stand by those statements about themselves, but I'm going to leave it there.
They're increasingly coming out against Hamas. There's all this pent-up anger that we're seeing now because they hold Hamas accountable. I don't say they like us, Joy. I'm under no illusions. There's a historical animosity that I understand. But they are furious at Hamas for starting this war and for torpedoing the ceasefire and for bringing this destruction upon their society.
All right. Well, we will have to leave it there. Please come back. Former Ambassador Mark Regev. Thank you.
Israeli Defense Minister Yoav Gallant says Israel is very close to achieving its goals in northern Gaza. He says the war is difficult, but claimed Hamas fighters are surrendering to Israeli forces.
We are very close to declaring victory in Gaza City and will continue our operations elsewhere. All those people whom we are fighting are facing one fate. They will be dismantled. This is also what is happening in Khan Yunis, and I would like to call upon them. I would like to call upon these terrorists and their commanders to surrender. I tell them now, surrender to save your lives. If not, your fate will be death.
Meanwhile, Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has reportedly been discussing plans for what happens next after the war on Gaza is over. Some Israeli media have published what they say are leaks of Netanyahu's conversations with the Knesset Foreign Affairs and Defense Committee. Imran Khan has more now from Tel Aviv.
Well, there's really two key things that he said, according to these leaks. The first one is about the Palestinian Authority. He said that the difference between the Palestinian Authority and Hamas is Hamas want to destroy Israel immediately, and that the Palestinian Authority want to do it in stages. Now, this is going to come as a big surprise to the Americans, who want a revitalized Palestinian Authority in charge the day after the shooting stops, or at least during the process of when the war ends in Gaza. But he also was talking about the day after. He said the Strip will be under Israeli military control. After the war, a civilian administrator will operate in Gaza, and the Strip will be rehabilitated under the leadership of the Gulf states. By rehabilitated, he means rebuilding. Now, there is precedent for all of this. Every time there's a war in Gaza, it's Qatar that generally spends millions, if not billions of dollars rebuilding. But I've spoken to the Qatari Ministry of Foreign Affairs, and they've said they haven't had any discussions about rebuilding Gaza. They are focused on getting a ceasefire and getting the Israeli captives out and an exchange for Palestinian prisoners. So they're not even talking about this. All of these comments suggest that Netanyahu is trying to sell the fact that he's in control internally. The fact that he hasn't actually come out and said any of these comments publicly suggests that. And this is what's going to be happening. He's got a tough fight on his hands, and he needs to sell it internally before even remotely trying to go to the Israeli public.
We're joined now by Marwan Bashara, Al Jazeera's senior political analyst here in the studio with us. Marwan, what do you make of these leaked remarks from Benjamin Netanyahu?
Well, clearly the Israelis are in a bit of a bind now, and there's a bit of disagreement among them. But they're also at the same time reaching to what they call an inflection point in Gaza. So there's a bit of a disagreement within the war cabinet. There's a bit of a disagreement about the war objectives. There's a bit of a disagreement about whether to prioritize the captives or the defeating of Hamas, which means either to continue with the war nonstop and even intensify it, or to find another diplomatic way in order to try and free more captives. And there is the images that are coming out of Gaza, the videos, are not very helpful to the Netanyahu government. If you watch some of those videos that have been diffused by the Hamas military arm, certainly Israel is getting a beating nowadays, even before, more than before. And if you add to that the numbers that have been declared by the Israeli hospitals and how different they are from the numbers declared by the Israeli army, all of that really starts to shed a light on a government in crisis. It's not very popular, Netanyahu per se. You know, he doesn't have the trust of something like 96% of the Israeli public that don't trust him, that they wouldn't take his word for fact.
Given what you say, then, does Israel feel that politically its window for the continued bombardment is essentially closing?
The window is closing, although they don't admit it. But if you listen to the discussions within the sort of former military generals and the strategic analysts and so on and so forth, they understand that there is some real American pressure, some real international pressure. There's also the economic pressure, right? Israel is losing something like $250 million a year, a day, which means it's going to really add up to a lot after 100 days of war. That's why the window is closing on this type of war. But that doesn't mean Israel would not continue in a different kind of war after, say, the end of this year, meaning they're going to something like, I don't know, maybe you could call it a war of attrition against Hamas. But clearly, because the window of opportunity is closing, and because Israel is getting a bit of a beating to its soldiers and tanks and so on and so forth, it's intensifying its bombardment against the civilian population. And that's why we're probably going to see more and more of these high figures of civilian deaths, including journalists and doctors and teachers and so on.
So is there as much so-called progress being made by the Israeli military as they would like the world to believe in terms of its fight against Hamas?
Look, there's no doubt about the dissymmetry of forces here. There is sort of a battle of narrative, a battle of images going on, but there is no doubt about who has more firepower, right? So Israel has more firepower. But there is an international pressure about the genocide that's unraveling in Gaza. There's international pressure, there's more American pressure, there's more Arab pressure. So Israel, in terms of its firepower, surely it will continue to destroy more and more as time goes by, more tunnels, more Hamas fighters, more civilian population, more civilian infrastructure. But how much time, right? So eventually Israel could flatten Gaza. But for the time being, while it can win the war militarily, it's slowly but surely losing the war strategically and otherwise. It says that it is a war between the forces of light against the forces of darkness. But more and more, everyone understands this is about genociders and occupiers against occupied.
And on a wider strategy, we've heard about Lebanon-Israel border clashes. Is that a matter of containment at the moment, or could a miscalculation change that?
For the time being, there's no doubt that it is one of containment. However, there could be miscalculation and it could widen. Interestingly, when the Israelis now talk about the day after Gaza, you would think, as the Americans think, let's discuss the two-state solution. But when the Israelis discuss the day after Gaza, they are thinking Lebanon. Now, that doesn't mean war. It could also mean a diplomatic solution that somehow pushes Hezbollah north of the Litani River as the Israelis demand. Of course, that will require other demands by Hezbollah. But it could also involve a preemptive strike on Hezbollah. And if that happens, then we are definitely talking about a wider war with incredible consequences for the region.
We'll leave it there, Marwan Bashar, our senior political analyst. Thank you.
The Assembly shall first take a decision on draft amendments A/ES10/L28 and A/ES10/L29 one by one. We now turn to draft amendment A/ES10/L28. A recorded vote has been requested. We shall now begin the voting process. Those in favor of draft amendment A/ES10/L28, please signify. Those against and abstentions.
The General Assembly is now voting on draft amendment A/ES10/L28. Will all delegations confirm that their votes are correctly reflected on the screen? The voting has been completed. Please lock the machine.
The result of the vote is as follows. Yes. 89 in favor, 61 against, and 20 abstentions. Having failed to obtain the required two-thirds majority, draft amendment A/ES10/L28 is not adopted. We now turn to draft amendment A/ES10/L29. A recorded vote has been requested. We shall now begin the voting process. Those in favor of draft amendment A/ES10/L29, please signify. Those against, and abstentions.
The General Assembly is now voting on draft amendment A/ES10/L29. Will all delegations confirm that their votes are correctly reflected on the screen? The voting has been completed. Please lock the machine.
The result of the vote is as follows. 84 in favor, 62 against, 25 abstentions. Having failed to obtain the required two-thirds majority, draft amendment A/ES10/L29 is not adopted.
Walk in the Gulf. Walk. Hey, everyone. This is DJ Chris Wired. Breakfast for Dinner is off this week. I will be back next week with a new show. In the meantime, I hope you enjoy this, and thanks for listening.
Hi, this is God. Whenever I'm in Pittsburgh, which is always because I'm omnipresent, I listen to every radio station at the same time, including WRCT.
You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh 88.3 FM. Esperando a que el sol esté a nuestro alcance, camino deseando encontrarse con alguien. Su odio matutino, su segundo nombre y algún sueño vencido lo acompañan muy bien. Lidia va con picardías y el servicio postal. Llevaba mangas largas porque así se exigía más a sus movimientos que lo integrador y el clima se desvistió en su abrigo nuevo. La magia fabrica.
Una promesa rota, palabras que rebotan. Una persona por delante y por detrás. Otra, una promesa trucha.